This is All In. I'm Miriam So. It seems like every day a new article or expose comes out about social media companies and how their products have a side to them that can create an environment where misinformation thrives and people are being targeted with psychological tactics to keep them engaged. Social media is a topic that has so many angles to examine, and it's quite fascinating when we take time to step back and look at all the technological advancements and ponder whether they're hurting or helping us as a society. And does the good outweigh the bad, or is it all creating chaos that is now out of control? With us now is Johan Bolin, professor of informatics at Indiana University. Welcome to the program, Johan.
Hi there.
So the Wall Street Journal has been doing a lot of reporting on this topic, and in particular, Facebook and Instagram's alleged harmful effects. A recent article I read titled, Facebook Knows Instagram is Toxic for Teen Girls, Company Documents Show, goes into detail about findings from within the company that their product was causing harm. Are you surprised at all?
No, not surprised at all. I mean, this is something that has been, you know, I would say circulating in the literature for, you know, half a decade. I mean, there's quite a bit of research, not just for Instagram, but a variety of social media platforms that were showing that they were associated with higher levels of anxiety, higher levels of depression, self-harm, not just for teenage girls, but, you know, for the population at large. And so there's been widespread concern about the effects that these platforms have on public health.
Well, there have been comparisons also between the tobacco industry and social media companies that they know their product is harmful, but continue to target the most vulnerable, including young people. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that analogy holds to a degree. You know, I mean, a lot of people derive pleasure from smoking tobacco products, right? And so it is a product that people enjoy. And, you know, I mean, you could argue that it's nice to have a cigarette break and, you know, people socialize, that there's some good associated, there's enjoyment associated with these products. But at the same time, they're harmful to your health. And it would be better if we didn't use them, obviously. And the producers of these products themselves were undoubtedly aware of the addictive and harmful effects of their products, but then, you know, continue to produce them and continue to sell them because, you know, they're a business. And so the analogy to a degree holds in the sense that, especially with this Wall Street Journal expose, is that Facebook might have been aware of the harmful effects of its platform, but they're a business, and you know they're probably also figuring out, just like the rest of us, whether these products, you know, on balance are good for society or bad for society, and so and for our mental health and our health in general. So it's a really tricky question, but I think that analogy, sort of addictive products that might be harmful for your health, holds up to a certain degree, because these platforms undoubtedly have addictive properties. And they do also mess with your mind, just like an addictive product does. And so, yeah, it's something to be concerned about. I think that, you know, we really, as a society, have to be very careful in looking at these products and these platforms, and see whether, you know, in my opinion, at least, whether you know, regulation would be necessary, whether the public should be warned, and then we also need to figure out how much these social media platforms knew about the harmful effects of their products.
When you mentioned that it's addictive, can you give us more detail on what's been found with social media and addiction?
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, addiction might not be the right word, but it's definitely the case that these platforms are engineered to create and sustain engagement, as they call it, which is a polite way of saying that they want to make sure that people spend as much time on those platforms as they can. And yet, how do you induce that? Well, I mean, of course, you can induce that by having good content, by having nice services, etc. There's also a number of psychological tricks that you can use, which, you know, are widely applied in, for example, the gambling industry, to condition individuals to continuously be looking for reinforcement, right? And in their quest for reinforcement, for example, receiving a message from someone, or receiving a like for a message that you posted, etc. You know, the game is to keep you involved as long as possible. And so, in you know, behaviorists have known this for quite a while. A lot of this is based on psychological theories, where you give people what they call, when you put them on an irregular reinforcement schedule, meaning that people are rewarded for what they do, through, you know, sound effects or likes or social reinforcement, etc. But you do it irregularly, And so the reason why you do it irregularly, because that has the strongest effect on the behavior, of sustaining the behavior. Because I mean, it stands to reason that if you know you'll be reinforced continuously, then you can rely on it, right? You don't have to engage with the product so often. But when it's irregular, people become suspicious and they start to associate all kinds of things with the reinforcement that they receive, and the behavior will be more persistent. And and in some cases could be compared to an addiction. I mean, you see this with gambling addictions, for example. Like, people love the rush of the game, and a lot of these gambling machines have been specifically designed to put in place reinforcement schedules that make people more prone to play for longer amounts of time and eventually to become addicted to the product. And I have no doubt that these social media platforms employ the same tricks.
It makes me wonder when you're comparing it to gambling, you know, people that end up with gambling addictions oftentimes I think they'll be banned from casinos, or they can opt into something where they can't go to these places. Is that something that should be done for social media, where people are limited from using it?
Yeah, I'm usually, but that's my personal opinion. Of course, I'm loath to regulate people's behavior in that way, right? I think a lot of people would agree with that. But by the time you're banning someone from the casino, you know, the damage has already been done, right? And so the purpose of the casino is to make money. It's not to support public health. It's not to make people happier, or it's not to give them a good time. It's to make money. That's what a casino does. And how does a casino make money? By keeping you gambling for as long as possible so they can extract the maximum amount of money from you. And so it's really difficult with that kind of a business model to fix the issue that some people get addicted to gambling. Besides, the actual addiction itself might, I mean, even as bad as it is, might be the tip of the iceberg, because for every single individual that gets banned from gambling because they're addicted, or they've shown sort of pathological levels of gambling, there's thousands of others who are also wasting a lot of money and happiness and time in these casinos, right? And so it's the same social media platforms. Facebook has 1.5, 1.7 billion users. Now, some people might be addicted to Facebook, and they might be banned, and might be all kinds of regulation applied to fix that particular problem. But what about the other 1.7 billion individuals that are on these platforms and that are subject to the exact same psychological effects as everybody else is, but perhaps not to such an extreme degree?
Yeah, it's like if you leave these platforms, there's still tons of people there. I often wonder about that too. You know, am I leaving people behind when I get off of social media? Are they just in another world from me?
Yeah, you know, I thought about this quite a bit as well. I quit my Facebook account in 2017, and I killed all of my social media accounts, including Twitter, for you know some of the reasons that we're discussing right now. Not because I was addicted, but because, you know, for me it was more of a boycott, you know, because I thought these platforms were having a deleterious effect on our society and on our politics. But I did have the same sort of personally the same feeling that leaving those platforms would isolate me from all of the other people that were still on those platforms. And in a way, by not contributing, I mean, you are impoverishing the environment for everybody else, right? I mean, I'm assuming you make worthwhile contributions. So yeah, I mean, the disengaging from environments like this is sort of, I think it's a worthwhile strategy. But you have to be, I mean, you have to be realistic. Everybody else stays on, and you know, you're, to a degree, you're also punishing yourself a little bit, because you're also losing the benefits of the social benefits of the engagements.
Okay, now you're making me feel like I need to log back into my account.
Yeah, that's the fear of missing out, right? You're thinking, what are these guys talking about? And does it involve me? Yeah, I mean, I've had that a little bit as well when I quit my accounts, but my social media accounts. But I will say that overall, it's been a net, for me personally. I can't speak for other people, but it's been a net positive, because I feel that, you know, on balance, I've been less angry, I've been less upset, and also I've been less prone to seek the approval of other people through, you know, the message and the photographs I post, etc. So I think or I hope rather that my personal interactions have become a little more meaningful because they're in person and they're not, you know, they're not conducted on a social media platform where I'm just yelling to the world about my you know, how great my steak was or how much fun I'm having on vacation, etc. So yeah, it's tricky because yeah, when you remove yourself from an environment like that, that is so important to so many people and that involves such great pluralities of our society, you become a little bit of a, yeah, you become a little more isolated in a sense. So that's the negative side of disengaging.
Right, and I'm in a little bit. I'd want to talk a little bit more about sort of the sort of moral or ethical dilemmas with social media and how when we see what's happening, but it's a tool that everybody uses. It's just like how do you weigh the good and the bad? But we're going to go to break in about 2 minutes. I wanted to ask you about some of the studies that you've done. If you can give us a quick snapshot before we go to break, and we'll continue. Talking more about your research when we get back.
Yeah, my research has actually specifically looked at the social networks that people spin on social media platforms and how that affects their well-being and their psychological states. And so the result, what we found may point to at least some of the reasons why social media platforms have the negative effects on people's well-being that we've been observing for the past decade.
All right, well, we will take a quick break. We're speaking with Johan Bolin, professor of informatics at Indiana University, on the effects of social media on society. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're discussing the effects of social media today with Johan Bolin, professor of informatics at Indiana University. Before the break, Johan, we briefly touched on some of the research that you do. What are some of the published things that you've released recently?
Well, we have a number of publications in the past 5 years where we're looking at sort of individuals and we're looking at their timelines, right? Their timelines of engagement with the platform, the content that they posted, for example, their tweets over time, right? So we can track individuals as they sort of move along a trajectory of engagement with these systems. And so these social media platforms, I will say this though, they provide a great research opportunity because you can not just over time look at what people post and derive indicators about their well-being from that content and sort of the nature of that content, but you can also reconstruct their social relationships on these platforms. So you can compare the two, how one affects the other. And that answers some really interesting questions with respect to how our social relationships affect our well-being and our psychological state. So for example, one of the papers that we did was where we looked at the density of networks, social networks surrounding individuals on, for example, Twitter. And so we found there that this rather famous popularity paradox is certainly also prevalent in social media. And it's relevant because it might explain to a degree why being on social media for some people at least can be such a negative experience. Maybe that in social it's sort of in real life social networks, there's this phenomenon where very popular people have a much higher chance of being connected to you as well. By virtue, they're popular, right? So they have a lot of connections, and therefore they have a high probability of also being connected to any given individual. And so when you look at someone in the network and you look at sort of the average popularity of their friends, that average popularity will frequently be higher than their own. And this will be true for a majority of people in the network. And you're saying, well, that can be true, right? You know, how can your friends on average be more popular than you for most people in the network? Because certainly there will be popular people who will be more popular than their friends on average are, right? But it's because these very highly popular individuals, they connect to everybody. And therefore, well, not everybody, but a lot of people, and they inflate the average popularity of large of the neighborhood surrounding large numbers of people, meaning that a majority, paradoxically, a majority of people in social networks, when they look around their sort of the friends that they have in these networks, will see that their friends on average are more popular than they are. And you know, you can that could lead to all kinds of negative social comparisons. But we've seen that effect is very strong in on social media platforms. And so, okay, so you could say, well, you know, being popular doesn't mean that you're less or more popular, has no bearing on your happiness. But in this research, we actually looked at what people posted, and we had our computer algorithms read those tweets and then extract an indication of how happy these people were, right, over time. For example, if they, you know, if you talk a lot about dead puppies and rain and cloudy skies, etc., that might mean that you're less happy than someone who's talking about sunshine and beaches and parties, etc. And so when we compared people's happiness to the average happiness of their friends in the network, we found the same paradox. So on Twitter, at least, what we found is that most individuals on Twitter, the overwhelming majority of individuals on Twitter, have friends that on average are more popular than they are, but also happier than they are. So most individuals on Twitter experience a situation where when they make a comparison between themselves and their friends on average, that comparison will turn out to be negative for them. And that might point towards some of the mechanisms through which social media platforms might exert a negative effect on our well-being, right? Because it means that large swaths of the population, when they go into social media platforms, they get the impression that their friends are more popular and happier than they are. So that's one paper that we published a while ago. We recently published a paper where we started looking for indications of language associated with what we call internalizing disorders like depression and anxiety. So this is well known, and it's actually what cognitive behavioral therapy is based on, namely that when that certain types of thinking are associated with depression and anxiety. These types of thinking are called cognitive distortions. It's things that people believe that are not true or maladaptive or overly negative. For example, something like, none of my friends want to hang out with me. Nobody ever calls me. I won't go to the party because I will have a bad time anyway. I'm sure I'll fail the exam. You know, nobody will ever love me. Those kind of things, right? Which demonstrably are exaggerated and not true in many cases. And so these patterns of thinking are associated with depression and anxiety. And so we can detect those patterns of thought, of thinking in people's language as well. So we looked at our social media data and we started looking for the prevalence of these markers of cognitive distortion in the language, like little snippets like I am a, for labeling and mislabeling, I will never, he will never, you will never, everybody, you know, those kind of snippets that are indicative of cognitive distortions. And we found very high levels of cognitive distortions in our Twitter data. And worse, we found that for people who had been diagnosed with depression, those cognitive distortions were also much higher on social media. So that means that from the language that people use on social media, we might be able to infer whether or not they are at risk of developing depression or anxiety, which are very serious mental health issues. But we might also gain some insights in how that type of language manifests itself online, how it might be encouraged online, and how it interacts with people's social relationships. In fact, we just recently published another paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, where we showed that over the past 125 years, we looked at the literature, all books published, at least since the 1980s in English, there's been a surge of markers of cognitive distortions in the English language, in the literature. And that might be indicative that it's not just social media, but there might be sort of broad societal developments that are biasing the English that we speak towards sort of an expression of these cognitive distortions. And of course, that's not a very good thing, because it means that we might all be becoming a little more, our cultural environment might be becoming a little more, I wouldn't say depressogenic, because that's probably not the right term, but might be more associated with depression and anxiety. And there's no doubt that social media platforms, because of their format, might actually be encouraging that kind of language and stimulating it through the social interactions that people have on these platforms. So that's just a very short overview of some of the work that we've done, but they do point towards the fact that our technological environment and these social media platforms may play a role, not just play a role in shaping our well-being through sort of biasing the social interactions that we have and biasing our perspective of the others, other people that we connect to, but might also be biasing our language towards the kind of language that we generally find associated with depression and anxiety.
So it seems like it's encouraging more negative reactions versus positive.
Yeah, the insidious nature of this is that it's not just negativity. Because of course there's negativity because, you know, anger and negativity creates engagement, you know, creates higher levels of controversy, will get your pulse ranked a little higher. In fact, that's one of the things that people were arguing about Facebook, is that their algorithms were changed such that conversations that generated a lot of engagement were moved up in people's feeds. Well, what generates engagement? Well, controversy. So the most controversial stuff, the things that got were most successful at getting a rise of people would percolate to the top. So that's definitely true. But that isn't just negativity. That's also just, you know, sort of controversy. But in the case of these cognitive distortions, it's also not quite negativity. It's the pattern of thinking. For example, something like IMA, right? We look for that particular pattern because that is a pattern that very often occurs when people are expressing a cognitive distortion of the labeling or mislabeling type. Like, I am a loser. So you're classifying yourself as something. You're saying, I am a loser. Well, if you're a loser, that's what you are, right? And so it's very dichotomous, right? You're not saying, well, sometimes I'm successful, sometimes I'm a little less successful. You know, some things I do really well. No, I mean, besides that wouldn't fit in the tweet so much, right? That you'd say I am a, and then a label. And that's a known type of cognitive distortion in cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's not so much that you're saying something negative. It's that you're expressing a type of thinking, a pattern of thinking that is associated with internalizing disorders and mental health issues.
This made me think of the changes that I noticed over the years on social media. I remember I was like one of the early adopters when Facebook came out. Yes, I'm aging myself.
So was I.
And so I remember when it was just a platform for relationships with people that you actually knew. And then it grew and you would be friends with people maybe you met somewhere once or twice. But I noticed the changes in the younger generations that started getting on Facebook. It would be like, let me post a picture and write a caption about how amazing I am. And I was just totally shocked. I was like, wow, like, this is the way we're supposed to present ourselves now. I felt so awkward. Like, I need to make pictures of myself and like write flowing poetry.
Yeah, we've invented whole new ways of socializing and communicating. I still remember that when I first heard about blogs, you know, my first response was, and it's probably how I was raised, and it's probably sort of a cultural bias, but I think, what makes you think you're so interesting that you need to have a blog? I mean, people are really going to read your, you know, opinions online. I mean, you're so important that we should all know about your opinions, because I was used to people publishing opinion columns in newspapers, but those would be journalists or important people that have important things to say. But just this idea that you would blog your life and talk about yourself, right? It was very alien to me. I mean, but that was just blogs. imagine how I felt about, you know, being on Facebook and seeing sort of people, you know, discussing their vacations and their how great their meals was, and even smarmier, how much they loved their wives and their partners. And, you know, it was shocking to me as well. You know, you're certainly not alone in thinking that was something new that hadn't occurred or appeared in the culture to that degree.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of relationships, whenever I notice, when I was online, because I'm not on social media now, but when I was there, I noticed anytime people would be overdoing their relationship status in real life, if I knew them, it wasn't like that. And so it seems like it creates a dual presentation of yourself, where online you have to show this amazing thing, but outside of that, it may not be so great.
Well, we've all become advertising agencies for ourselves, right? We're a brand and we're doing the branding, and everybody understands that the advertisement is not always an honest representation of the product, right? So, yeah, I mean, there's sort of a broader discussion about how these social media platforms are really advertising platforms, right? And so what is being advertised? What's the product? I mean, we're the product. And, you know, it's a little bit like people watching TV and choosing to watch the commercials. You know, I mean, on TV, we try to fast forward through the commercials or avoid them by getting subscriptions, etc. But on social media platforms, we choose to engage in an advertising platform where everybody's essentially advertising themselves, where everybody's to a degree branding themselves, right? And that leads to that could lead to very unrealistic expectations if you believe that those are realistic depictions of people's actual lives and personalities and experiences.
When you look back over time, could you have predicted that we'd get to where we are now? For example, older platforms like MySpace, was it only a matter of time before bigger entities formed?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just bigger entities. I think they're slightly different animals as well. I mean, MySpace was largely sort of a blogging environment, right? Which, as I mentioned back in the day, seemed very strange to me, right? That people would be advertising themselves in such a way. But yeah, I was honestly, perhaps it's, you know, I'm a little bit like the writer and philosopher of online environments, Gerard Lanier, who was involved in virtual reality, developed a lot of the technology there, was really at the forefront of these developments. And back in the early noughties, I was very much involved in online social networks. And I think the general belief there was that these anarchic environments would liberate society, would liberate us from social oppression, would liberate people's creativity, their ability to communicate freely with anybody they liked, without middlemen, without sort of, you know, newspapers and journalists and big TV television corporations deciding who should watch what and when. And so there were a lot of hopes in the community involved in sort of this, in this area. And I think a lot of people didn't quite expect how things were going to evolve. And I think it is because they underestimated the power of people's desire to make money. And so these early environments, they were intended to be the sort of these anarchic environments where people could freely communicate and freely say their minds, avoiding censorship, social conformity, people freely connecting to other people as they saw fit. But of course, there was a money opportunity. There was money to be made. And so what we gradually saw, and that was not fully anticipated by myself, and I think that's true for a lot of people involved in that research, is that what we didn't fully anticipate is the how corporate interests would absorb that movement and turn it into the platforms that we have nowadays, which I agree with Gerard Lanier, is that they're largely advertising platforms, not just for ourselves, but we're also being sold as a product to advertisers, you know. And so I think we all underestimated the power of business interests in shaping these environments.
You know, I read Jaron Lanier's 10 Arguments, I think it was called. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that pushed me to acknowledge what I've thought all these years, that something was feeling off and different. But, you know, I'm wondering, you're so open with your views. We have about a minute left here. Did you receive any pushback?
Yeah, I talked to friends and, you know, some of them really regretted that I went off social media. I mean, it was flattering because they wanted me to be there. So that's nice. But yeah, a lot of them also thought I was overreacting a little bit. They didn't think that it was necessary to do this. And some of them, you know, feel that they can safely engage with these platforms and reap the benefits without necessarily suffering the disadvantages. And so I respect that opinion, but I wouldn't call it pushback. I mean, as a scientist, I will say this, though, I think it hurt my citation numbers a little bit because I can't talk about my research to an equally large audience anymore. So I'm mostly doing this through, you know, established journals and conference proceedings, etc. So I'm no longer discussing my science online on Twitter and Facebook. And so in that sense, I am losing a little bit of the advertising or branding benefits of these platforms.
And that is a little bit ironic that you're in this field, but you're not actively participating.
Yeah, people will remark that from time to time when they learn that I don't have a social media presence. But it seems ironic. But I will say this, though, these environments are an amazing opportunity in the history of the social sciences to study human behavior. And both at the level of sort of our mental health, but also at the level of how we form relationships, how information propagates through these social networks, how our relationships change over time, how they affect our well-being. So these are like big questions in social science, and these environments have created the data, perhaps inadvertently, that allows scientists as myself to address rather important big questions that would otherwise be very difficult to address.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're speaking with Johan Bolin, professor of informatics at Indiana University, on the effects of social media. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Johan Bolin, professor of informatics at Indiana University, is with us today as we learn more about human behavior and social media use, whether it's harmful for us, changes our thinking, and if there's any good in it. Johan, is there any good in social media?
Yes, undoubtedly. I mean, I was really impressed with a study a while ago that showed that you have to actually pay people quite an amount of money to quit social media platforms. So these were, I think, a team of economists that were trying to see how much you need to bid for people to agree to not engage with social media platforms. And on a monthly basis, I think it translates to about $40 or $50, if memory serves me well. So they concluded that social media generates about $40 or $50 worth of benefits to the people that engage with these platforms. So people are getting benefits from these platforms. There's no doubt about it.
Once you know that there are some negatives with it, how do you justify still using it, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. And so, again, this is where the analogy with, you know, addictive products like tobacco, et cetera, is relevant, right? I mean, I had a friend and, you know, he liked to smoke a cigarette from time to time, right? He didn't like smoking so much, was not addicted, but he just liked to smoke. Most of us, many of us drink alcohol, which demonstrably is not very good for your health, but we kind of, you know, weigh the benefits. We enjoy what it gives us, and we enjoy the taste. We love to do it when we're in a social environment. Sometimes we like to be a little inebriated, but we know it's not necessarily healthy for us. And so, you know, I decided to just, quit at least Facebook and Twitter. And I still have sort of an account on LinkedIn that I use sporadically for business reasons. I think everybody's kind of for themselves personally trying to figure out, you know, how much am I getting out of this, and what are sort of what's the danger to my well-being if this becomes too important or too addictive for me? But that's one sort of, those are sort of personal ethical and moral questions. But I think as a society overall, I think we will have to come to terms with the notion that we have literally billions of people on these platforms. And if these platforms have even a slightly negative effect on our well-being, that really affects the well-being of hundreds of millions of individuals. I mean, the total mass of unhappiness that could be caused by these platforms could be enormous. And so again, that's where the analogy with smoking comes up. And you may choose to not smoke, but I don't know how old you are, Marion, but you know, I'm 50 years old. So I grew up in the 70s and the 80s when lots of people smoked, and they smoked everywhere. And just you not smoking, you'd reap the health benefits of not smoking, of course. But everywhere you went, you were still exposed to the smoke of other people, in bars, in restaurants, in planes, in buses, everywhere you, any public space that you went, people would be smoking. And so then as a society, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, people were coming to terms with this idea that perhaps we need to do something about this. Perhaps that is not acceptable for us as a society. Perhaps if people smoked less, that would be better for all of us. And then the regulators and the law and the government stepped in to solve what was essentially a tragedy of the commons in that sense, right? Because when everybody smokes, you can personally choose not to smoke, but you'll still be exposed to the smoke of everybody else. So you've divorced yourselves from the benefits, but you're still, to a large degree, suffering the disadvantages.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I just had this memory of when I was a kid and traveling on an international flight and smoking was still allowed. And now if you said that to somebody, they'd be like, what?
Yeah, it's unimaginable. You know, I remember in my home country of Belgium, you know, you'd go to a restaurant and you'd be having a meal and then people around you would be lighting up. And I still remember what a long, difficult march this was, you know, and they're trying to curtail smoking in restaurants because everybody understood it was unfair for a non-smoker to sit in a smoke-filled room, especially when they were trying to enjoy a meal. And I still remember sort of the sort of the very inadequate solutions that they have. Like, for example, there would be a smoking compartment in the restaurant, but it was essentially just a bunch of, so what they would do, because everybody smoked, if you didn't smoke, they would put you in the non-smoking chair, right? As if that solved the matter. But it was just a very difficult to convince people not to smoke because they enjoyed it so much and they were addicted. And so if you were a non-smoker, you were essentially sort of a beleaguered minority that had to convince a majority of the population that what they were doing was damaging to public health, right? And so some people go, oh, it's not bad for me, I don't care. Yes, for you, that's a trade-off you're willing to make. But you're also forcing all of us to suffer the consequences of your ethical choices. And so I think with social media platforms, we may be in the same situation where we really have to think a little bit about, what's the minimum age requirement to engage in these platforms, for example. I mean, I'm not proposing anything, but for smoking and alcohol, the regulators have stepped in and have really trying to put the heavy weight of government on trying to solve this problem, which is, again, it's a tragedy of the commons. Sometimes you need the government to step in and regulate matters. Otherwise, if the government hadn't stepped in and tried to curtail smoking, I'm sure that there would be kids on planes right now, right? I had asthma, and so I'd be on a plane, and the plane would be smoke filled, people smoking everywhere. Just not a very healthy environment for a child,
Well, I've been thinking also about the inequities in real life that seem to continue, even in an online world where supposedly it's a level playing field, but eventually it seems like the same patterns seem to emerge. Is that based on the way these algorithms are designed? Is it just the way human behavior is?
Both. I think it's how human behavior is, right? I mean, I teach a course on collective intelligence, and one of the things that comes up is meritocracies are fair in the sense that everybody's rewarded according to their ability. But since abilities are not distributed equally, the benefits of meritocracy also always accrue with the same people. And so you get very strong, very high levels of inequality. And so, the situation here is, the same phenomena that you see in real society will of course also be manifested online. And, I think a Facebook representative recently issued a statement saying, these things also happen in real life. And if they happen in real life, you'll see them on Facebook. You'll see the same social phenomena on Facebook, and to a degree that's true. But what they then fail to mention, of course, is that their algorithms might very well latch onto these societal phenomena and exacerbate them, and exacerbate the negative effects of these effects. And to give you an example, we did some research on homophily, namely that people prefer to associate with other people that are like them in terms of their religion, their language, their ethnicity, their socioeconomic status, etc. This is true. This happens in real life. But these social environments, these social media platforms, they have recommender systems. Facebook proposes friends to you, saying, oh, here's a good friend for you. On the basis of what? Well, perhaps it's an algorithm that compares whether these people are sufficiently similar to you in a number of aspects, right? That we may or may not agree with. And so what that leads to is a situation where a normal human tendency to homophily is amplified to a degree that could be very unhealthy, much unhealthier than it would be in real life. So these algorithms are specifically designed for reasons of profit, but also for reasons of keeping people on these platforms as long as possible, keeping them happy, etc. They're designed to play into social phenomena and amplify them, and that could lead to some very weird results or deleterious results.
Is there any way to make social media more equitable?
I've thought about this a lot, and I think that it would be fair to say that I don't know. I don't know, because I think this is also Lanier's argument. It's just really difficult to do this because, first of all, we're a social species. So people are, we need social relationships to be happy, to be productive, right? So that is a given. that we seek these social relationships, and we've evolved some apparatus to manage these social relationships. These social media platforms, of course, they allow us to establish these relationships. They play into this, but they play into it for profit. And so once you put these two things together, I really wonder how, you know, you can make these environments more beneficial and more equitable. I've thought about this a lot, and I don't necessarily see how that could be done. I don't think I have an easy solution.
Yeah, I think it's tough, because if you start, let's say, your own platform and say, well, I'm going to make this more, you know, equitable and make sure everybody has access. But then eventually I feel like things come back to the place where it's just everything's the same at some point.
Well, and there's also the problem of natural monopolies. Like, these environments, their value increases as more people join. And so they tend towards monopolies, where you have one big social network and everybody's on that network, because the value of that social media platform grows as more people join. Right? So it's very difficult for you to start a new social media platform. I think people have recently been making some attempts to do that. And, you know, I don't think they were very successful, because these environments tend towards natural monopolies, because scale matters. The more people are on it, the more valuable they become. And so if you want to develop a social media platform that is more equitable, well, good luck, because it might never take off.
That's a positive thought.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is a real downer, I guess, but that's how these environments go. They're just like, the water systems, the electricity systems. The more people join these systems, the more efficient they become, the more valuable they become. And so they will tend towards natural monopolies. And that means you're stuck with the social media platforms that we have. Also, they're private enterprises, which means that, you know, even though we're collectively using them, we have very little say in how these algorithms are being organized and how these environments are being set up, how the user interfaces are designed, because these companies have the right to organize these platforms as they see fit, but they tend towards natural monopolies. So in a sense, they become utilities, but they don't have to act like utilities.
Right. Well, how would you say people can connect and function without social media? The people who are listening, who are like, you know, I've never been on it, or I'm going to get off of it.
It's very easy. I mean, try it. You know, it won't hurt you. That's my recommendation. See how that works out for you. Quit social media. Quit using it for a while, and then, you know, I mean, if you feel that it delivers the kind of benefits to you that you seek, and none of the disadvantages a lot of people have mentioned, then perhaps it is good for you. So you should then you will revert back. It's a little bit like I have friends, for example, that do what's it called, Dry January, where, you know, after the holidays, you stop drinking for a month, right? And some of them liked it, and they haven't, you know, they haven't been drinking since then. And some of them, like myself, decided, well, perhaps I like a glass of wine from time to time. And so, yeah, my recommendation is try it. See whether you can live without social media. I predict you will find that you can live without social media, and it might have, you might feel better going for a nice walk rather than to be, you know, glued to your phone all the time, checking updates and seeing whether someone liked or didn't like your photo or your message, which is also not a pleasant situation to be in, because I don't think it's good for people to constantly be looking for the approval of others.
That's definitely something that I think became more prevalent with the way social media is. Again, this is me speaking from the position of seeing the world before the internet and then seeing it now, and
yeah.
And being on it for so long, realizing that a lot of the things that I would be creating or putting out from the artistic side of my life, not in the journalism realm, it was always like, what can I do for people to respond or to interact? And then the art loses its meaning, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a resident DJ in one of the, we play house music in one of the local clubs here. And as a DJ, your wish is for people to dance. And so, you know, there's a lot of pressure on you to play the music that people like, so they will dance. I mean, I can play this, I can exercise my art and play, you know, play a perfect set. But if nobody dances, it's limited, right? So there's that. But then there's the, there's being on social media platforms and seeking the approval of people for things that are not artful, but that are related to your personal business. Like, I ate a steak. Do you like, yeah, you know, other people like it. They like that I ate a steak, or, or, you know, I did something cool. Post on people, you know, I can't, am I supposed to care whether, you know, I did something cool for myself and whether they liked it or not? I think that's a very strange sort of type of social interaction. So this, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that there's definitely a sort of situations where the approval of others, especially in art, is the objective, right? If you're an artist, you want people to appreciate and enjoy your art. Right? So you'll make it public and you'll hope that they appreciate it. And then there's sort of this, so you can put that, you can drive that too hard and then be on social media where you post a meme or post a photo of yourself, and then you hope that people will approve of you as a person or approve of your personal activities. And I think that's perhaps instances of the same thing, mm-hmm. but you are not the art necessarily, right? I mean, you're not a, I don't look at people as products or brands that seek approval. So I guess what I'm saying is that the approval of others is important to us, but these environments exaggerate the social tendencies, and it might lead to unhealthy situations.
And I think, you know, also depending on your career area or things like that, like I know, for example, in journalism, of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, like these things are used to research, find sources to connect with people, to let them know about programs, etc. So I feel like in some aspects, like I personally would be okay with engaging in that way, but not in a personal level where it's all about me.
Yeah. And I have friends who, and colleagues who essentially use social media as advertising platforms or announcement platforms. They make announcements, they report on the latest papers, they have little snippets explaining what the paper does for the public, etc. And yeah, I appreciate that. It's very valuable. Absolutely. And so these environments are very good in propagating information. But as I've recently noticed, is that these environments can also distort science itself. You know, I mean, you publish a paper, and then before you know it, someone who hasn't read the paper has an opinion about it, and then people start to discuss there's a lot of misinformation out there as well, and people can get into quite a state talking about these things where, you know, the representation of what happened in reality is no longer truthful on social media. So even when it comes to announcements or distributing information on these social media platforms, you have to be careful that the information is actually reliable and it doesn't take on a life of its own and becomes false or misconstrued.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Great discussion. Johan Bolin, professor of informatics at Indiana University. I'm sure we could talk about this for days. So much to talk about in different angles. So thank you so much.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.